when we get any older.
That's right. That's right. So I just wanted to go through a few of the slides. So I'm on the January 06 deck. And as I mentioned before, I did go through a lot of the charts and stuff with Eugene Hsu this morning. So I'm not going to go through those unless you think that he wouldn't have been able to give a good understanding. It's my understanding that he's the one that sort of did all the data work behind those. But
that's right.
Okay, great. So if you go to page 9 on this deck, the last bullet, if home price appreciation rates slow down to 4% per annum for the MSAs, which was the Metropolitan Statistical Areas, is that right?
Yep.
Currently having double-digit rates, losses, both defaults and severity ratios may increase substantially in these MSAs. How did you come to this conclusion? I mean, was there data behind this?
Well, if we look at page 8.
Okay.
You see that on page 8 we have this thick line at the top. That the average home price appreciation for that line is 3.67%, and that number is about, call that 25 roughly.
So 3.67 rounding up to 4,
right.
Is that sort of the idea?
Right. So at 4 you get about 25% defaults. Historically that's what happened. And then if you look at the lowest line here, where home prices are going up at an average of 12.7% per annum, the default rate is more like 6. So it was our view that the difference here is 4x, right? 6 and 24, call it. It's 4 times. And the difference in home prices is 12 versus 4. So it was our view that to the extent that home prices went up 4% per annum in those places, the default rate would be close to 24%, or certainly far, at least double what it had been, right? So that's what we mean by may increase substantially. I mean, I would call it doubling substantially. And if you look at this data, it was a quadrupling is what, and is what it was here.
Did you do any controlling for other things that might have made losses different in the highest quartile versus the lowest quartile?
This to me was so significant when overlaid with we talked about in the very beginning about how much you would pay out in premiums versus how much the windfall would be if you were right, that I felt that it wasn't necessary to do that to be sort of persuaded it made sense. But what is true is that many people that I pitched said, you're missing something. This can't be right. Like the conclusion you're reaching, it's like a bridge too far or what have you. And there were many people that said that, and one of the reasons that the book grew over time was an attempt to answer some of those questions. So people said, it's about unemployment, it's not about home prices, or it's about migration patterns, population, and that's because it was a pretty radical thing to say that these securities were going to default if home prices only went up 4% a year. So it wouldn't be that crazy to say, hey, home prices are only going to go up 4% a year. That doesn't sound like a wildly, like, doom is coming prophecy, right? But saying these bonds are going to default was sort of like saying doom is coming, and people felt that doom wasn't coming, obviously.
So if you go to the June 07 book, to slide 32, was this one of the things that was added to sort of beef up the book in response to people pushing back on that point? Or was this something different?
Yeah, I mean, that's related. I think this was just what our...
Cause I haven't looked at just, no, take a minute.
Okay, so this was a model that Eugene built that looked at, and we may talk about it somewhere. There's a publicly available database called Loan Performance that a lot of market participants subscribe to. So we looked at that data, I didn't look at that data, but Eugene looked at that data, and he built a model. I think he looked at some huge number of loans, and it may be footnoted somewhere, you know, 91,000 loans or not 91 million loans, but some big number. And he took what home prices had done in all these different MSAs and tried to project, okay, well, the default rate is X where home prices go up 12%, and it's Y if home prices go up 6, and we have two MSAs in the whole country where they went down 1% or what have you. He tried to, you know, do a again, I'm not a math person, but a regression analysis that sort of filled in the blanks between that. And so he built a model that predicted what defaults would do given home prices based on the historical data that we saw. Now, many people, so this didn't answer the question of what about the other factors, because this is just our model's opinion of home prices and how they affected it. There were many people who said, but you're overweighting the importance of home prices and you're not putting in enough unemployment. Like your model says, and again, this is just making it up, but for example, the default rate goes up at, you know, this slope versus home prices, and other people say, well, it doesn't. It's actually completely uncorrelated to home prices. It's correlated to unemployment. So, like, you're saying that for every 1% lower increase in home prices, defaults go up 5% or whatever, and we think that's wrong. So, like, our model ascribed a certain value to the change in home prices, how it would affect defaults, and other people said no. So this doesn't address in any way, this page, in any way the other factors that people suggested were more important.
Did you do anything, any analysis to try to account for the other things that people raised?
Yeah, I think in one of these you'll see the unemployment.
Okay,
yeah,
I think I remember.
So if you, pages 29 and 30 was our attempt to answer. Some of the stuff was unanswerable because it was very hard to get data, so people might have, you know, this whole population trend thing, like that was really hard to answer that question, and that was just one where we agreed to disagree. Say to somebody, if you don't want to short them because you think it's population trends, okay, I'll go talk to someone else. And, but 29 and 30 shows, I think it's very interesting to compare, if you stay with the June one, 24, if you look at the chart of 24 versus the chart of 30, see, I saw something here that the bulls didn't see. They were presented with the very same facts, and they just believed something different than I believe. So on page 24, the difference between the low home price area, right, was 26. I didn't realize it actually said 20. Well, now maybe we didn't have that the first time.
Right.
We were estimating it on the old one.
Right.
But here we figured out, someone's like, well, how do I know what that number is? We put it in. So you see it's 26 for the 4% up home price, and it's 7 for the 12.25% up home price, right? So that's almost four times. Now, if we look at page 30, you see that the place where unemployment is the lowest in America was 3.8%. It's 10. Interestingly enough, the place where unemployment was the highest in America is the one right next to it, 6.26. It's 11.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, or even if we look at the third quartile, where unemployment was 5.28, it's 19. So when I look at 24 and 30, I conclude unemployment isn't that important. Home prices is very important, right? The difference between high and low is almost four times. The difference between high and low here isn't even double. And between the high and the lowest, it's 10%. It's like nothing.
Thanks for pointing that out. I hadn't focused on the fact that these weren't in order on this right side.
Well, they're in order
on page 30.
Of defaults, but not of unemployment.
But not of quartile, right. Which is, that's...
Right. So I looked at this and I said unemployment is not that important, home prices are. And most market participants on the long side thought it was all about it. Because they would have looked at this and they said, well, this doesn't account for it. And if you go back to page 29, some of the things that jumped out to me on page 29 are, one is if you look in the lowest quartile, North Dakota and South Dakota, mm-hmm. You see how they have basically the same unemployment rate, 3.33 versus 3.6. And then if you look at the six-year home price appreciation, North Dakota, it's 6% per annum. That's not a good example because they're about the same. But if you look at, it's a good example is if you compare either the Dakotas with Hawaii, right? So North Dakota and South Dakota, they're right sandwiched around Hawaii. Right, 3.33, 3.45. In North Dakota and South Dakota, they have about the same home price appreciation. and they have about the same default rate. Slight different. I mean, even there you can see home prices in North Dakota are going up at 6%, and South Dakota they're going up at 5%. The default rate in North Dakota is 13%. The default rate in South Dakota is 18%. And they're right next to each other on the map, right? I mean, I've never been to either one, but I don't know that they're that different places. But they have a huge difference in defaults. Sorry?
That's off the record for the people from.
I haven't been there. I mean, America is a great country. There's a lot of wonderful places. I've been to some of them. I haven't been to all of them. And then Hawaii is right in the middle of them from an unemployment perspective. Home prices are going up more than double, and the default rate is like one-third the average of North and South Dakota. So other people would look at that and they would say, well, that's because more people are moving to Hawaii because the climate is better. And I said, no, it's the unemployment is the same. It's just the home prices are different and defaults are different. Other interesting examples to me are Florida and Georgia. They're in the second quartile. Mm-hmm. So you see Florida and Georgia, they have almost the same unemployment rate, 458 versus 472. Florida home prices had gone up 12.8% per year, and defaults were just under 10. Georgia home prices had gone up one-third as much, 4.33, and defaults were almost triple, 25.2. And then the last one of these that I will subject you to is if you look at California, you'll see California actually had one of the highest unemployment rates in the country at 5.9. Home prices going up 12.63, just a smidge under Florida's. And lowest defaults, I think the lowest defaults in the country, or one of the lowest defaults in the country, at 4.61. So other people, when presented with this, and this came from the U.S. Department of Labor, you know, this public information, other people presented with this, they saw something different than I saw. They saw that it was that people were moving to California, and that was, I don't know what they saw, but I saw that unemployment wasn't that important and home prices was really important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. There are slides in, I think, both of these decks. And the first one is slide 11. I'm not sure what slide it is in the 07 one. That says most top issuers are not regulated banks, and then it's got this list of the originators.
Yep.
What was the significance of this? I mean, what was the point of this slide?
It wasn't one of the slides that I recall using as part. Like, when I sat down with an investor and I went through this book, it wasn't a slide that I frequently or even occasionally referred to. I would sort of say to people, we're going to sit down for as long as you want, but a half hour to an hour is generally as much time as someone would give me. And I'm going to highlight the slides that I think are most significant, and I'm going to leave this book with you to look at the entire book, because I think everything in here has some relevance. Mm-hmm. So I didn't think this was a particularly important slide. But some people would ask me, well, who originates this stuff?
Did you ever factor in fraud? Did you ever talk about mortgage fraud as part of your analysis?
No. Or not that I recall. The biggest thing to me, I would say two things. The biggest thing to me was that home prices were really, really important. And I wasn't ever on the origination side of the business, so I didn't really know the loans that well. What I knew was these charts that showed me that home prices and defaults were really correlated. What is true is I was cognizant of the increasing percentage of loans that had no documentation might be an issue.
Okay. If you turn to page 24 of the 06 one, it talks about the 2005 vintages being the most risk layered.
Uh-huh.
Could you just walk me through sort of what this slide means?
Sure. I think that what, and I didn't entirely, this was a slide that Eugene put in more on his own.
Okay.
Like a lot of the things were sort of my idea, hey, figure out X and put it in, and some of them were his idea. This is one of those. But I think that what we were trying to portray here was that the loans, not only were loans becoming, you know, that the only way to keep, you know, the housing market going was to continue to make loans that were more and more aggressive, more and more easy for a borrower to pay, less money down, et cetera, higher debt-to-income ratios. But also that not only were more loans having risky factors, but that they were having more than one risky factor. I think what risk layered means is more than one. So for example, it might be okay to give somebody a high loan to value ratio loan as long as they had a very good credit score. Because you'd say if this person has a great credit score, I can lend them 100 cents on the dollar because they've always paid their bills on time. Whereas another person who had a low credit score, you might say, I can't lend them more than 70 cents for the property because they haven't demonstrated the same willingness and ability to pay as others. And other factors would be interest only. So you might say, if you want an interest only mortgage, you have to have a lower loan to value ratio than if you're willing to have a principal and interest mortgage.
And then if you flip to page 27, this is the downside and upside of shorting subprime mortgage mezzanine bonds. I think you talked about this a little bit, but you thought that there was a 30% likelihood that you were right, roughly?
In January of 06, yeah.
By June of 07, you were presumably proven correct on that?
My confidence grew over the time, yes.
Would you ascribe percentage levels of your confidence over time?
Yeah, it was probably 80 or 90 by, I don't know what it was by then, but home prices had started to go down. And I think the issue really is when I started this, home prices hadn't gone down, they were still going up. So I think there are two components to whether this trade would work. You know, one is whether home prices will in fact moderate or not. And then two is, to the extent that they moderate, is it relevant, right? The bulls would have said either A, home prices are going to keep going up at this rate forever, or B, if they don't go up, it doesn't matter because what matters is unemployment or population trends or any of these other things. So for me, sort of, to be right in my investment thesis, I needed not only for home prices. My own opinion was that defaults wouldn't increase unless home prices moderated. And so my own thesis was that home prices will moderate, and then if they moderate, my theory that moderation is relevant will be proven correct, right? So when I started this short, home prices hadn't moderated. So that part of the puzzle hadn't even come to pass. It wasn't until really September of 06 that home prices start to moderate. So by September of 06, sort of the first criteria for me to be right had happened. Home prices had started to moderate. The second criteria was for people to actually not be paying their mortgages. And that's beginning to happen. You know, in the fall of 07, I think New Century went bankrupt because of...
Do you mean 06?
No,
07. You meant 07?
07 is when...
Fall of 07?
The first quarter. I said the fall. I meant the first quarter. The first quarter of 07 is when New Century goes bankrupt for a variety of reasons, one of which was that they were having a lot of what's called first payment defaults. The borrowers weren't even making the first payment. So my confidence grew in the fall of 07 because home prices moderated, and then it grew significantly more in the spring and into the summer, in the fall of 06 when home prices moderated, and then the spring and the summer of 07 when the delinquencies began to happen.
If you go to, I think it's 41, there's a slide about credit ratings. We haven't really talked about the credit rating agencies. But if you could walk me through what you're trying to say with this slide.
Is this in the appendix? Because I don't remember ever looking at this slide before.
Oh.
But it is. The book has my name on it, so I appreciate that. I must have.
We could talk more.
I can talk about it. I understand it completely. I just don't. It's sort of. It's not one that I. It wasn't one that was a big part. This was a. I would say that. I feel confident in saying that this was one of those that my hour was up, and I said, read the whole thing if you want or not.
Looking backwards, you can see how we might be more interested in hearing about credit rating agencies. So.
Absolutely. So I'm happy to talk about it. So I think all we are establishing here is explaining to people how we understand, you know, and we probably got this from our new issue guys. You know, our new issue guys said, we said, how do they rate deals? And our new issue guys told us, this is how they rate deals. And it's very logical that this is how you would do it. You would, the agencies had their own model that looked at quality of the loan in terms of the loan-to-value ratio, the credit score of the borrower, the geography of the loan, and all of the different factors about loans. They had their own model that came up with their predicted loss amount for a given pool of loans. And, you know, I remember that some pools, they said, oh, we think 5% is going to be the loss rate, and another pool, they thought it would be 5.5%, and they would size the different tranches accordingly. So from the rating agency's perspective, the rate, you know, they can rate, it doesn't really matter whether the loans are of perceived to be high quality or low quality, because they can adjust the credit enhancement accordingly. So a pool of low credit score, high loan-to-value ratio bond loans would have more credit enhancement for a given rating than one of high credit score borrowers with low loan-to-value ratios. And they would say a triple B is a triple B is a triple B. And it doesn't, you know, these loans are lower quality, but the credit enhancement is 7%. These loans are higher quality, and the credit enhancement is 3.5%. So, like, the triple B is equivalent across that.
So just to make sure that I'm clear, this would be the credit rating agency's approach to rating subprime mortgage-backed securities, but which I'm trying to distinguish from CDOs.
That's correct. The next thing, this would be useful for subprime mortgage securities, for prime, for Alt-A, for any kind of, you know, for securitization of mortgages. CDO is the next thing you would need to do with the CDO. This is about mortgage-backed securities of any ilk. To do a CDO, you would then have to say what is the. It's similar, I guess. What you would have instead would be the default frequency for a given rating. So we believe at XYZ Rating Agency, we believe that triple B's default this frequently. You would need the loss severity ratio, which would be if a triple B defaults, how much is it going to recover? And then you would need the correlation, which would be what is the plausibility that if one of these defaults, that more than one default. So, like, let's take a very extreme example. If I was making a CDO of two things that were the opposite of each other, that in no way could they both happen at the same time, right? The correlation is zero, meaning that if X happens, Y, it's impossible for Y to happen. So if you were to do that, you could, and those two securities were both individually rated triple C. They were very distressed, but somehow in this example world that we're describing, there it was impossible for them both to default. Maybe one of those securities was based, you know, on long investments in oil, and the other one was short investment in oil. So they couldn't both not work out, right? Either oil was going to go up or it was going to go down. So if you were to do that, you could rate, even though they were both rated triple C, you could have a triple A 50% tranche, right? Because you'd say, well, it's composed of two things. They can't both default by all math. They can't both default. So half of this is triple A. And if you thought that if one of them defaulted, it recovered 50 cents on the dollar, for example, you'd actually say 75% of it is triple A, because we'd get zero on the one, we'd get 100 cents on the one that paid off, and we'd get 50 cents back on the one that defaulted. So even though we put together two things that were rated triple C, we would create something that was 75% triple A in this example. So what the agencies needed to do to rate a CDO, which is not discussed here at all, would be to say, well, these triple B bonds that have been put together, how much are they going to recover if they default, and what is the likelihood of a lot of them defaulting versus just a couple of them defaulting?
But if there's they assign in the first instance a probability of default on the RMBS tranches, mm-hmm. and if they make a mistake there, then that mistake filters through to the CDO process.
Yeah, well, I think they made two different mistakes. The first is the likelihood that the triple B tranches were okay, because most of them weren't okay. And then the second issue is if one of them's not okay, how many other ones are not okay? Those are two very different issues, right? So the rating agencies believed that the defaults on these pools were going to be 5%. So they were wrong about that, because it was much more than 5%. But what was also the reason that you could take a bunch of triple Bs and create something that was mainly triple A was this, the same thing that was the main difference between Howie Hubler and Morgan Stanley and Deutsche Bank, was that the belief of the rating agencies and the belief of Morgan Stanley was that if they defaulted, forget about whether that was likely or not likely, which is a separate question, but if they defaulted, very few of them would default, as opposed to that they would all sort of default or none of them would default. So they, my opinion about the agencies would be that they made two different kinds of mistakes.
Did you ever interact with the rating agencies at all?
That wasn't part of my job. Running secondary trading, we didn't really talk to the agencies, and then even where we were working on something like a re-securitization or what have you in the secondary market, someone who worked for me would have talked to them. I did sit in on one meeting in the ASIVEC. I did suggest that some of the short people meet some of the rating agency people to sort of check their own facts. In terms of maybe you want to be short, maybe you don't want to be short. Like, I've told you what I think about these securities and these loans and how defaults could play out if home prices moderate. But why don't you talk to the rating agencies and see what they think? Because, they are the established authority, and I'm this iconoclast that's,
And your thesis is disagreeing with the ratings, essentially.
Well, I would say that I disagreed with the correlation assumptions in CDOs. And then separate from that was, if home prices had kept going up, I think that they would have been absolutely correct about losses. So I don't think that they were wrong about, I think it was more, it wasn't that I disagreed with their assessment of the viability of the securities in benign environments, because I think if the environment had continued to be benign, the bonds would have been fine. So the reason that I was short them wasn't so much directly, oh, home prices are going up or not, but rather the different payout profiles of the two investments, right? So if home prices keep going up 12% in Florida and California, I'm going to lose 4. And if they don't keep going up, I'm going to make 80. So I didn't disagree with Moody's saying, if they said home prices are probably going to keep going up, that's fine. Probably is okay. If there's a 33% chance that they're not going to keep going up, the windfall related to investing on the short side is multiples of the profits of investing on the long side. So I didn't disagree with that's.
I mean, maybe this is a little outside your purview, so just tell me, but I'm curious, given your experience in the market, wouldn't the probability of home prices not continuing to go up have been something that they ought to have considered?
That's not my area. I mean, it doesn't seem like anybody really considered that.
Do you want to follow up on that?
But I have some other questions.
I think there were a lot of people, as we talked about before, who believed that even if home prices didn't go up, that these bonds would be fine, right? They believed that as long as unemployment stayed low or as long as the migration trend. So I think that one was to consider whether home prices could moderate or not. But the second was, and I think is a very important difference, because there were a lot of people who looked at these charts and said, you're wrong. Like, it's not about home prices, it's about something else. So I think there may have been people who considered the possibility of home prices going down, but it wasn't that they didn't think of that, it's that they didn't think that that would be as important as it turned out to be.
Okay. Sorry, I'm almost through this. 47, slide 47 on that same deck.
That gotta be like the last page. Yeah. Okay.
This one, I just have some questions about. It sort of goes through how the ABS structure works, and then it talks about over-collateralization can be built up, and then it says the third bullet, after the crossover date, mezzanine and subordinated bonds start to receive principal simultaneously. What's the crossover date?
Sure. That's a legal, or not legal, that's like a prospectus term. So what it generally meant was the day, the way that these deals were typically rated, and again, I wasn't a new issue person, so I kind of understood this, but it wasn't something that I was too involved with. But after 3 years, the way that things work is they required that for the first 3 years, as it says, the first few years principals pay to the senior tranches, and X's interest can maybe be paid also, which grows the over collateral. OC stands for over collateralization. After 3 years, you would look and see if things are performing well, if the deals are going, if they're meeting certain triggers, and the triggers generally were the delinquency rate is less than a certain number, and the loss rate is also below a certain number. To the extent that they were meeting those triggers, and it was usually 3 years, the crossover date was usually 3 years after issuance, they would say, all right, there's been enough built-up time, the AAA is safe enough that we can now start to pay these other bonds. I mean, ultimately, when you're making a new securitization, you want the average cost of the debt to be as low as possible. So the way to do that would be to pay off the high debt triple B bond earlier, as early as you could. And this is how they came up with it.
Okay. So now if you switch to the, I think it's June 07, go to slide 15.
Okay.
If you could just explain to me what this is showing.
Sure. Slide 15 is what we got from MCF, you know, what we believe to be the issuance of ABS CDOs each year. And so what we were trying to say is some people would respond to sort of they say, I agree with a lot of, am I on the same page?
Yeah, yeah.
Hi, Greg, you've moved back one. Or
I was one. Yeah, I think I'm. I think I was. My notes are. I was sort of like, why am I? Yes.
Okay. Is this the page you want me to talk about?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So, sometimes investors would say, "Everything you say makes a lot of sense, but how come the price of these securities isn't going down?" Because by the end of if my recollection is accurate, by September of 06, there is a. You know, home prices are starting to flatten out. But the price of these securities isn't actually going down. So there were investors who said to me, well, you say that if home prices flatten out, these bonds will suffer. And a year ago, home prices were still going up, so you were not right. And now home prices are flattening out, but the bonds are still going up, so you're not right. So, like, why do you still think you're right if the price of the securities is not going down? So what I
said... Well, it's not just the price of the securities, right? It's the volume.
Well, the price of the home equity securities. This is CDOs.
Oh, okay.
So the point of this slide was the reason that home equity securities prices are not going down is because the CDO market is so vibrant that it is, you know, the price of a security reflects fundamental and technical views, right? People have opinion about the securities in terms of the likelihood of things going well or poorly for them. And then on top of that is how many people have a bullish view versus a bearish view, right? So whereas by the end of 06, or this book was written in June of 07, by the end of 06, the fundamentals were siding with me in the sense that home prices were moderating. The technicals were not siding with me because the CDO market was creating so much demand for these products that even though home prices were moderating, which should have encouraged people to be more prudent about making mortgages and whatnot, the CDO market was fueling demand for the product, which enabled loans to be made that you know. So the point of the slide was, I'm not wrong because prices are going up. I'm wrong because there's lots of CDOs happening. That's why I'm wrong right now.
Why do you think the CDO volume in the mezzanine subprime mortgage tranches or the ABS mezzanine tranches, I mean, why do you think that volume was increasing so significantly given what you knew at the time?
Well, there was a lot of demand from institutional investors to buy CDOs. And there was an increasingly willing supply of CDO collateral from hedge funds willing to buy protection and other. So you can only do a CDO, a synthetic CDO, if someone's willing to get long and someone else is willing to get short. So before 05, there really is little to no derivative market, right? So this is almost entirely cash CDOs, right? So it's just how many asset-backed securities are there that we can put into a CDO? How many people want to buy CDOs, right? That's the market. 2005, we start to do some synthetic CDOs. So now it's a question of in 2005. And in 2005, we could have done, and by we, I just mean Wall Street. I don't mean Deutsche Bank or me or any of that. But I think the reason that the number in 2005 is smaller than 2006 is because there weren't that many people willing to buy protection. Not that there weren't that. I think the number of people willing to sell protection or to buy a CDO didn't change that much from 2005 to 2006. But what changed was the number of people willing to buy protection on it.
So the volume is attributable largely to synthetics.
That's correct.
This gives me sort of a good opportunity to ask what impact the development of the synthetic market in general played in the financial crisis.
Sure. I think from the perspective of Main Street, the synthetic market resulted in less pain. And the reason I say that is that without people shorting subprime, the housing bubble would have continued a bit longer. But ultimately, I think with the benefit of hindsight, people, most people would agree that home prices had reached levels that were not sustainable for income, and the loans that were made were not prudent loans and whatnot. So it is my view that the synthetic market brought an end to the housing bubble sooner. So from the perspective, a simple perspective of home, let's just say that the today's price is the appropriate price for a house, just for simplicity's sake. So and that house today is trading at $100. And at the top it was $130. So the people that bought it at $130, they've lost $30. Had it not been for synthetics, I think that the housing bubble would have continued for some amount of in greater time, and the home that very same home that today is $100 would have reached $140 or $150. It would still be $100 today. So from the perspective of Main Street, I believe that the synthetic market sort of ended the housing bubble earlier, so there was less direct pain for people because the person who bought the house at 130 had the pain, but he would have sold or she would have sold her house at 140 to someone else who would have lost even more money. On the other hand, it's inarguable that synthetics resulted in Wall Street losing a lot more money than it would have otherwise. So I think on a direct basis, Main Street lost less because of synthetics than it would have otherwise. But to the extent that the money lost on Wall Street hurt Main Street, then synthetics increased the pain. But more directly, I think without synthetics, Wall Street would have lost almost nothing, and Main Street would have lost plenty. In fact, maybe more than they lost. Whereas with synthetics, Wall Street lost a lot of money as well.
So the point, just let me clarify, the point about synthetics sort of cutting off the housing bubble is that you don't need the actual mortgages anymore to continue making taking the long and short positions, and so there's not as much demand for the cash securities that create the demand for more mortgage products. Is that the...
I think that the synthetic market helped... stifle, you know, more and more aggressive lending. So we would have perhaps seen 50 or 100 year mortgages issued had it not been for synthetics.
I apologize if you covered this while I stepped out momentarily. You, in your book, seem to recommend you make the argument for going short, but you really only argue, and correct me if I misunderstood this, only argue for going short in one way, which is single name pay-as-you-go swaps. Theoretically, leaving equities aside, you could have gone short ABX, you could have gone short CDO tranches. Did you also pitch those or no?
Well, it's all part of the same general trade. So many people looked at this and said, okay, I'm going to short the ABX because it's more liquid and transparent. So you've convinced me to short the ABX. Other people looked at this and they said the real interesting thing is to short the CDOs, because there's even more bang for the buck there. So this, the building blocks for the short thesis are the single names.
I see. And did you have views on the advisability of one method versus another?
The ABX was more liquid than single names, and CDOs were far, far less liquid than single names. So I would certainly say to people, it depends on your perspective. If your perspective is that you want to do this for 3 weeks or 3 months, you should probably do the ABX. If you have a longer term horizon, you should do one or the other. If you're willing to sort of ride it to the very end, then maybe CDOs make sense. If you want to cover this at 50, when they're trading at 50 cents or 20 cents on the dollar, you probably want to do the single names. So that.
Building on the questioning that Dixie had at the end, some academics speak of synthetics having an effect. They speak of it in terms of derivatives amplifying the credit crisis. I suppose because they focus on the fact that instead of there being one RMBS triple B tranche, you now can have 10 times, longs and shorts of 10 times that amount. It then seems that the discussion, although the terms are amplification, if I understood what you were saying, one continuation of that discussion is that it created greater credit losses in the system, but then there was a redistributive effect, essentially, from Wall Street to others who took the short position. And maybe I should have just asked the question rather than going into all that, but care to comment further?
Well, I think that the synthetic market resulted in the Wall Street investment banks losing a tremendous amount of money and a bunch of hedge funds making a tremendous amount of money. That sort of is separate and distinct from what else was happening, right? So the housing bubble would have been, it is my view, the housing bubble would have been worse but for synthetics. So from that perspective, I think the synthetics were good for Main Street because it stopped the bubble before it got even more inflated. And then the question of whether it's worthwhile that a bunch of hedge funds have money that used to be in investment bank's capital is a moral question. That's, you know, a lot of those hedge funds, their investors are pension plans and whatnot. So the money that, you know, it could be as simple as XYZ pension plan had investments in Lehman stock, and they had investments in a hedge fund. So their Lehman stock didn't do so well, but their hedge fund investment did do well.
You've made it clear you weren't on the origination side. But in terms of origination of mortgages, do you have a view on whether the ability to hedge affected the activity of the origination side, even though at a certain point in time there was a market signal in price from synthetics in bursting the bubble, but at an earlier point in time, would you agree or disagree that the ability to hedge by certain various parties in the securitization and origination chain led to more product? Were led to looser underwriting standards because of their ability to hedge?
The ability to hedge definitely didn't lead to looser underwriting standards, in my view. I think it actually made underwriting standards be tighter, right? Because if there was no way for somebody to short weak underwriting, the ability to make more and more weak underwriting would actually increase. So I don't think that would be... I think it's the reverse. I think that the weak underwriting was met with shorting, so weak underwriting had to be stopped. I think it's been sort of shown that not enough hedging was going on. So I don't think the people that were originating these originated more because they could hedge, because they actually didn't hedge. Right? They, pretty much everybody who was in the origination of these securities lost money in that process. So they didn't hedge.
You said that you disclosed to, in your marketing efforts, that you were short. Again, you were not on the origination side in the CDO business, but do you know if they disclosed that another part of Deutsche Bank was short?
I think Deutsche Bank as a whole was net long, so if we were to disclose anything, we would disclose that as a firm we were long, but I think that it's our duty to give customers accurate information about the securities for their own right to buy them. But you wouldn't, I don't know that it would make sense to say, well, we've got this one guy, he's short five. We've got this other guy, he's long seven. So we as a firm were long. Deutsche Bank as a firm was long throughout this, so I don't think they would need to disclose that. We got one guy over here who we all think is crazy, he's short. The rest of us were more long than he is. That would have been what they would have had to what they would have disclosed, and I don't know that you know, matters.
But with regard to a synthetic CDO, if Deutsche Bank were the arranger, there'd be a disclosure that they're the initial swap counterparty. Right?
Yeah, I think you were talking about just in general the new issue business, but not specific transactions. Or
I was actually, I found your answer adequate, perfectly fine. I was referring to new issue CDO origination in particular.
So in those cases, it was the new issue CDO business was either the securities were selected by a manager who picked them all, or it was a static pool where the short counterparty was disclosed as us, and here's the pool. And if you like the credits that are in the pool, you know, invest, and if you don't invest.
Is there anything else about, more generally, about the causes of the financial crisis that you would like to say for the record as part of the commission's oral history?
The causes are, there's a lot of different causes, and it's very hard to think back. And my own view would be that the first seed of the cause is that home prices went way too high, and the culture of the more people who own houses, the better was a mistake.
How do you think you were able to see something that so many other people weren't able to see, at least at the time? I mean, it seems pretty compelling, so I'm just wondering. Although, obviously, we have the benefit of hindsight now.
I don't know how to speculate about what other people saw or didn't see. I try to approach things with, when I look at situations, I try to not judge them based on what I want to see, but based on what I do see. So I think that most people in the business wanted to see things continue to be good for a long time. So that's what they saw, because that's what they wanted to see. I didn't want to see things not be good. It was very difficult to take such a contrarian view, particularly throughout 2006, to be sort of mocked or ridiculed. It was a difficult thing to do. But in looking at the data the way I saw it, I saw that home prices were extremely important to this. I think other people didn't see that because they didn't want to see that. I didn't want to see it either, but I didn't let that enter into my analysis.
Was there anything missing that sort of should have made more people see sort of the weaknesses in the system and earlier? I mean, this is a sort of like a structural question or a regulatory question about what you think should have been done differently that could have sort of prevented the problems that you saw and identified?
I think it's human nature. There's been bubbles. It's, you know, the famous tulip bulb mania in Holland, or, you know, 300 years ago. So no.
I had one more. It's flown.
Well, maybe we can follow up with you if we need to.
Hopefully a quick phone call.
Yes.
Sure. Thank you very much for taking the time to meet with us.